Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand, this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I'm just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Well, good evening. Happy Shabbat. Welcome to Yada Yada Radio. I've got both Kirk and JB here. How are you guys this evening?
Good. Doing good.
Great. We had an interesting exchange, and I want to just read a letter from someone many of you may not know. Although I know him quite well because he has been very involved in not only proofreading chapters that I have written, but in making suggestions to them. And I began to CC him on some of the correspondence that I've gotten. And in the last week, I've had two people who have written that have come out of Christianity and have come to know Yahweh, engaged in the covenant, and participating in the Moed Mikre, and have shared their journey. It's a journey that is very common now to many of us. And in this particular exchange that I had with the individual, I shared the letter with James, and his response to a gentleman whose name is Jason was marvelous. And Jason's two questions were, one is, is there any earthly fellowship here? I mean, is it, are we spread so thin and so far apart that, we are going to be celebrating most of the Moed Mikre individually as opposed to collectively? And I think he also had a question about, ascertaining the timing. And so this is what JK, and I don't think he would mind me reading this. He certainly has a gift in communication. It's the second person in a week that he has written a lovely letter to. But I just love the tone of this, one of my favorite in a long time, so I want to share it. It reads to Jason. This is wonderful news, and I'm grateful that I'm one of the few who had this message shared with me. I also don't have any friends or acquaintances on the path, or even close friends, who can relate to me despite my sometimes eloquent, logical arguments. Like Yada, I find company with Yahweh and the set-apart spirit more than enough to make it a grand celebration, whether it be the 7 set-apart meetings or the weekly Shabbats. As to the proper timing, I'm sure that if we put our enough human power to the task, we come up with the answer. Perhaps we can behead a chicken and see if it runs in circles or in a straight line. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. Yahweh answered this question so brilliantly for me that I can know for sure when I celebrate the Moed that it is the appropriate time. That's because he didn't specify exactly when it should be done. when Hezekiah's alliances failed him, when tribute of gold and silver did not sway the Assyrians from surrounding Jerusalem for their final crushing assault, he turned to the Torah. After destroying the pagan religious altars and relics polluting the land, after rediscovering the Torah's guidance, he realized that the time for Pesach had passed. So Hezekiah appealed to Yahweh to celebrate it after the fact. Yahweh did not respond with, "Sorry, Charlie, you blew the date. Better luck next year, if you happen to survive." No, indeed. Yahweh told Hezekiah, "Of course, celebrate the Mikre." And not only did Hezekiah and those in Jerusalem do so, he reported that the people were so enriched by the experience that he requested to extend it further. Yahweh, again, pleased with the request, responded with approval. Meanwhile, the massive Assyrian army was wiped out by one of Yahweh's vast array of spiritual envoys and messengers. Given all that, do you suppose that Yahweh is fixated on the exact timing? Whether we rely on the astronomical, observational, or Hebkal dates, we can be assured that it is close enough to the proper perspective of timing, probably more so even than Hezekiah and his people observed. Is it therefore more important to understand and observe the significance of the eternal memorial to one of the most amazing events in human history? I'd say yes. Forgive me for droning on, but before I was mature enough in my walk, I got into a discussion with a colleague about his assertion that his Holy Bible was the inerrant word of God. My response should have been, "You think God would ever allow his words to be corrupted?" Well, how about this? Quote, "Surely he never said you couldn't eat from any tree in the garden." End quote. Consider just that one phrase, that one-liner from the Torah. If you thoughtfully think it through and carefully examine its implications, those dozen or so words open up a universe of understanding. I can't adequately express the thrill I feel for you. Thank you for sharing your experience. James Karlovic. Isn't that lovely?
It is, well.
I just love the humor in it, how personal it is, how well it's written, how each question is addressed based on the Torah teaching. It's amazing how those of us who have become serious about coming to know and understand Yahweh just get it. His sentiments reflect my own. There isn't one iota of message there that I wouldn't concur with 100%. And even if there were, it's so well backed up, it's so well written, I would embrace and celebrate even the subtle differences. But that's really the beauty of where we all are. This is a thinking man and woman's relationship. And it is an expressive relationship where our words make a difference in people's lives. And so I thought that was exceptionally well written. In the news of the day, one thing I think I should share is evidently, for the first time in 250 years, we have a national emergency. Were you aware that we had a national emergency on our border? I wonder why someone didn't realize it might have been a national emergency like 100 million Hispanics ago. But nonetheless, Trump was unable to get legislation through Congress. I'm not sure he's actually gotten any legislation through Congress declared a national emergency so that he could fund the wall that he swore to us during the elections the Mexicans would fund. Do you feel safer? Do you think a crisis has been averted?
No.
Now, I, for one, and I'm not political, so my conclusions here are irrelevant, but I've long suspected that the only reason that we have a immigration problem is that we have essentially made Central America, the northern part of South America, uninhabitable. And it's not just America's lust for narcotics. It's the duplicity of government for being involved in the prohibition and the war against them to make it an incredibly lucrative enterprise, and then being involved in the distribution through places like Thailand, Vietnam, and now places like Afghanistan, Azerbaijan. And so it is this duplicity of declaring a war on something that funds so much clandestine activity in America that fills our prisons so that we are the most incarcerated nation on earth. You know, you want to know a prison state? It's America. 1% of the adult male population is imprisoned. Why? All because of this ridiculous war on drugs. Now, I'm not advocating drugs, and I think everyone who has ever listened to this program or read my books knows that I am not an advocate for illicit drugs. I can't say that from a position of knowledge. I've never even used marijuana. I know nothing about the effects of drugs other than the standard brew. You know, I'll drink a beer, have some wine, have a cup of coffee, having one right now. But apart from that, I know nothing. I have no interest in knowing anything. I rather like the normal state of mind. I don't see any advantage in numbing it, dulling it, or taking it into a fantasy world. But I do agree with Iowa. Free will is important. And so we're far better sharing with people that being intoxicated is a really bad idea. Iowa speaks against it all the time. Being intoxicated is a really bad idea. But you should be free to poison yourself any way you want to. If religion is free, then I tell you what, it's a lot more deadly, a lot more toxic than any drug. Mm-hmm. All right, Nat, cut through the news. I'd like to begin two statements before we left off a week ago, just because I rather like this. I like it because it reinforces a theme that I think is essential to our understanding, and that is that when Noah is conducting the Teruah harvest, where somewhere between 700 and 7,000 souls will be taken home. I rather like the number 7,000, but it's hard to support looking at how many people we know that have come to embrace the terms and conditions of the covenant. But once that happens, they are being removed from what is going to become the most horrid situation the earth has ever experienced. And they're being taken to a place of absolute perfection, joy, and beauty. And the primary difference between these places is religion and politics, militarism and patriotism. The place that is so uncivil, that is so barbaric, that is so deadly and destructive and damning, is the place of religion. It's the place of politics. It's the place of patriotism. It's the place of militarism. And the place that those few souls are going is a place completely removed from all of those things. reads, and this is Yeshayah 17:7. In that specific day, now this is the day of the harvest, and he's speaking to those who have been gleaned. This man, Adam, will actually gaze upon, genuinely regard and accept the Almighty, the one who engaged and acted to get this done. And his eyes will choose to continuously look toward the God, or toward God, the set-apart one of Israel. Now, I know we went through this a week ago, but just think about that. The moment we're away from this corruption and the pollution of religion and politics, militarism, patriotism, we can actually gaze upon the Almighty. And we're going to look at him primarily as the one who acted to make this possible. This is Asah. Make what possible? The Teruah harvest. Well, the Teruah harvest isn't possible without first having completed, fulfilled Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, and Shavuah. Without fulfilling and honoring the promise of Passover, the doorway to life, Matzah, the threshold to perfection, Bukurim, our adoption into Yah's family, and Shavuah, empowerment and enrichment, then there is no harvest. There could be no harvest. There's no way we would endure this transformation from three dimensions to seven. There's no way that we would be able to exist in the presence of Almighty God. And so we're going to look at Yahweh as the Father who acted in support of his children in this way so that we could be there. We're not going to look at him as, you know, this miracle worker. We're not going to look at him as one to be worshipped. We're not going to be looking at him as this divine presence on a podium or throne. We're going to look at him as the one who acted on behalf of this relationship and this harvest to get it done. That he's committed to the relationship, that he personally engaged to enable this result. And we will choose to continue to look at the set-apart one. Oh, the Kodesh is the Ruach Kodesh, but of Yisrael, not of some goddamn church, not of some ridiculous denomination, not of some stupid book, or faith, or belief, or modern country, but of Yisrael. This story begins with Yisrael, and it concludes with Yisrael. Powerful. And then that's followed by, So then he shall never accept nor gaze upon these works of his hands, representing what fingers have made. They will not focus either upon that which is associated with the Astras, the mothers of God, the queens of heaven, the Madonnas with child. Man-made religion, gone, obliterated, never considered again. Religion not only isn't the path to God, it is the thing that God is most annoyed at. It's the thing that is expressly excluded from heaven. Rather than religion being the means to God, it is the means to be excluded from God. And of all of the religions on earth, there's two in particular that celebrate the Asherahs. You know what those two are?
Christianity and Islam.
Christianity and Islam.
That's it. Yep. Exactly. Christianity and Islam. In Christianity, it is overt as it is in Islam. And someone might say, wait a minute, I'm a Christian. I don't celebrate Asherah. Oh, yes, you do. Easter. It's named after her. Easter is her primary holiday. Christmas is the result of her. She is the Virgin Mother. If you're amongst the three quarters of Christians that are Roman Catholic and Orthodox, her little statues are in the vestibule of every church. The remedy for sin is saying, Hail Mary, the Lord is with thee.
The Lord is with thee.
Yeah, well, the Lord is with thee, but the Lord just happens to be Satan.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is
not a good thing.
No, of course not. This is the blessed and favored relationship, the goddess of grace, Asherah. You know that was the goddess of grace? Of good fortune in the pagan mythology, represented as the blessed mother, consistently worshipped in concert with the Lord, Baal, a.k.a. Satan. The god El is symbolized by a decorated tree and sacred wooden pillar. But do you know of any decorated trees that are religious in origin?
Oh, yes.
You know what's so interesting today? Yeah, what's so interesting today is that as America is becoming, and Europe, overwhelmingly more secular, you know what's becoming ever more popular?
Was Halloween?
Yeah, Christmas, or Halloween, Christmas trees, Christmas lights, Christmas carols, Easter egg hunts.
Yeah.
Trick and treat, all of that stuff, and they'll all say, well, I don't have any religious views on it, it's not religious to me, it's just a fun time, you know, how could anybody, including God, be opposed to just having a good time with family? The nation becomes secular, the world becomes secular, the more popular these celebrations are. And of course, what is the revered and worshipped sacred wooden pillar?
The cross, of course.
Cross.
Right. And the crucifix, of course, it's dead God on a stick. And even in the non-Orthodox, non-Roman Catholic variations, it's the torture device. And I can't even fathom how anybody in their right mind would choose that as a logo. Well, particularly the dead God on a stick, but even as the torture device. But maybe it's apropos, because every time one is risen, every time people bow down beneath one, it tortures God. Asherah.
The perfect symbol to represent an organization and a belief system that will lead you to eternal torment.
Yes, it's also good for that, isn't it? Eternal death. That dead God never gets off the goddamn stick. Asherah was part of the Trinity, the Babylonian religion, the Assyrian religion, the Phoenician religion, the Armenian religion, the Canaanite religion, a mother goddess upon which Roman Catholic religious festival of Easter was conceived, the idol of the Madonna and Child, statues were built to emulate her. The pole upon which the Christian cross was derived, the basis of the Christmas celebration and Christmas tree, as I say, the second person of the religious Trinity, also known as Astarte and Ishtar, Queen of Heaven, the Mother of God, later worshipped as Venus in Rome, from Ishtar to pronounce blessed, to receive blessings, to relieve suffering, to make happy, to engage in a relationship, and to show the way. So they will never again focus upon either the Asherahs or the worship of sun god images. Come on. Now, again, I can hear the occasional Christian out there saying, no, I don't don't worship any sun god images. Celebrate Christmas. Where's solstice? Do you celebrate Easter? Vernal equinox. Do you worship on Sundays? Whoop. Do you go to a place called a church based upon church, the goddess associated with Helios, sun god? Do you call your god Baal, was the lord of every sun god religion?
Now, there's a church I drive by like every day on my way to work, and they got a big billboard out front, and yeah, they got the lettering up there. I guess it's to save money. They don't put Sunday worship. They just, you know, abbreviate it to sun, but they don't bother to put the period to show its abbreviation. So it literally says sun worship, 9 a.m.
Perfect.
Well, at least they're being obvious about it.
Yeah. A Easter sunrise ceremony, right? Mm-hmm. It's just all perfect. It's
Feebles
just,
to catch the first ray of the sun.
Right. Feebles, the first ray of the sun, the last ray of the sun is during the day. Wreaths, circular, because of the circular disk of the sun. Halos over religious images. All sun god related.
Well, they worship flags at the stars. They worship obelisk in Washington. Even if you're secular, if you think you're secular, you've been political, you're exactly in the same boat, same symbols.
Right. Well, what do you think the obelisk was designed for? First and last rays of the sun. It is a phallic symbol and a symbol of the sun, the sun's rays. Come on. Industrialist, idolatrous, pagan worship. Well, you say, wait a minute, I'm a Christian. I'm not a pagan. I've got no idols. Well, but your Trinity is pagan. Your gods are based upon pagan gods of yesteryear. So I'll say you're not pagan. And, of course, one of the interesting things about Shemesh, it's also the word which means to be leavened, to be embittered, to be oppressive, cruel, and ruthless. So the Hebrew word for worship of sun god images is the same word to be leavened, to be yeasted.
That's
pretty telling, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So when we deal with unyeasted bread, matzah, what are we symbolically having removed?
The corruption of religion.
What? I mean, that is correct. Yeah, that is correct. You know, the statement provides a contrast.
People don't do the research
like
on their own religion. You know, when I was like 12 or 13, I took the time to sit down, because I was nominally raised Christian. We were taught all this, and we did this stuff. I was like, all right, well, where is Christmas? You know, where do we get Santa Claus from in, you know, the whole birth of Jesus? You know, where do we get Easter? I sat down and did some research. It took me all of 10 minutes, and this was before the Internet. You know, I went to a public library, got a few encyclopedias, and in 10 minutes, I was going, well, all this stuff has this pagan origins. This is all full of bull. And that's why, you know, I just gave up. I'm like, I'm not going to follow these religions. Now, I'd stumbled around through agnosticism for a long time before I came to the truth, but, you know, it doesn't take much effort to find this out for anybody. Why would you not take the time to, you know, ask yourself these questions and then research it? You know,
Right. You're
doing this every year. You teach your kids to do this, but you don't know why. It's just because it's what you've always done. And I cannot get that mindset.
Yeah, and it's so frustrating today because so many people, you know, I have a son, and his wife are now, by their own definition, socialist secular humanists. And yet they put up a Christmas tree. And yet they celebrate Christmas. And of course, for them, it is a marvelous and enjoyable time with their daughter. And he knows it's bogus. He knows it's a religious festival. He doesn't look at it that way. He just looks at it as a marvelous time with his daughter. And he is among the majority today.
Mm-hmm.
And when you say, you know, I don't want to play. I'm not going to wrap up gifts and sing carols to you or with you. And, you know, you just look at it as really a curmudgeon, just out of sync with the social fabric of the society? Why are you so much of a downer?
Yeah.
I'm not a downer at all.
That's like, you know, an even better example is what literally yesterday, you know, Valentine's Day, the celebration of St. Valentine. St. Valentine was a Catholic saint. Why would anyone outside of the Catholic Church have any desire to celebrate this person?
Of course.
Yeah. Why would even your nominal Christian or your Baptist, you know, you would think you'd have, you left the Catholic Church because of stuff like this, but now you're adopting it just because it's commonplace.
Right. You know, Halloween is All Hallows Eve. It was a Roman Catholic holiday that they usurped from the Romans. And from the Irish as well. It was a very popular European pagan holiday, All Hallows Eve. And it was incorporated wholesale into Roman Catholicism, just like Easter was and Christmas were both pagan holidays, just usurped wholesale into Roman Catholicism and therefore Christianity, as was Sunday worship, all because if you create a religion that has common threads with what the people are already accustomed to doing, it's really easy to fool them and control them. By the way, I didn't mention, but Asherah Day is the most important holiday for Shia Muslims, and Sunni Muslims celebrate it as well. They even call it Asherah Day. One of the things that was kind of interesting, speaking of the birth of God, God wasn't born. Little baby Jesus didn't have a birthday. And most certainly wasn't December 25th, the winter solstice. He arrived, of course, on Tabernacles, but he wasn't born God. Born like just any other normal kid. He didn't manifest the set-apart spirit and become uniquely the Son of God until the set-apart spirit came upon him as he was being immersed by Yahochanan in the Jordan. But you know, we have this whole myth that has been made up of Jesus of Nazareth, right?
Mm-hmm.
Heard of Jesus of Nazareth?
Of course.
Mm-hmm. All right, Kirk, you are a historian. That is your, after art, probably your second favorite thing, right?
Yep.
Why don't you tell me a little bit of the history of a place called Nazareth?
God, Nazareth is...
Ever studied Nazareth?
Not in great detail, but my mind is racing back to something that was... no, I'll just have to bow out. I'm sorry.
Okay. I didn't know this. Found it out this week. There is no place called Nazareth. There never was.
Really?
Absolutely. There was no place called Nazareth ever. There isn't any mention of it in any Hebrew, Jewish document. And you can't find a people that are more meticulous about their nation and their people and their places. It ain't mentioned anywhere. Do you know what the Nazarene, and he, by the way, he wasn't, by the way, it's not a Greek word or an Egyptian word or anything like that, too. It's based on the Tsar. Tsar means something. You know what it means?
No.
What was Dode called, and the single most repeated title for Dode, who, by the way, is the only one that in the context of a beloved son that and ruler that Yahweh anointed, therefore, as called, that he anointed really is, and used the term Asiyach.
Mm-hmm.
But Nazar happens to be one of three or four Hebrew words that describe the number one title used of Dode and also of Yosha. Well, you should get it from this.
Son, I mean, it starts
branch
with
number. Branch. Branch.
Oh, branch, yeah, of course.
Yeah. Yosha is a branch off of Dode. Branch off the Tree of Lives. branch. It's not a place. It's a title. There's just so much of just Christianity that is so screwed up and bogus. For example, Jesus of Nazareth. I'm sorry. But there was no such place.
No Jesus, no Nazareth.
No Jesus, no Nazareth. Neither one ever existed. Yeah.
Well, that was worth calling in all by itself. That was just
I knew that that there was nothing to be learned by it, and I knew that he most certainly wasn't part of the Nazarene vow. You know, the Nazarite vow, which is, you know, you don't cut your beard, and there's all sorts of aspects of it. Yeah, don't drink wine. Clearly, it was not part of the Nazarite vow. And there was no place called Nazareth. So, it probably is an invention of Constantine's mother, you know, just like the monastery on Mount Sinai and all that sort of thing. And, of course, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Yeah, it's all Constantine's mommy.
Great showmanship, though. It brings in the crowds. Hook them while they're young.
It does ring in the crowd. All right, back to Yeshaya 17 now. We've just covered 17:7 and 17:8. This is where we actually left off a week ago. In that specific day. So, has a long time passed? Are we talking about events that are going to take place over the millennia or over decades or no? All of this in that specific day during this time. It shall come to be that the cities of his refuge and his defensive fortifications shall be abandoned and deserted, consistent with an occult presence among the religious and the merchants of death. And then the uppermost branch of the olive will be completely deserted for a time because of the presence of the children of Israel. Then there will be appalling desolation and stupefying ruin. Well, so the first thing here we learn is that at that time, the defensive fortifications of the cities are going to be abandoned and deserted. Does that mean, guys, that that the world's capacity to wage war, its weapon systems are going to be blown up and destroyed? Is that what that says?
No.
What it actually says is that the defense of these places, inhabitable places, are going to be abandoned. Now, that's an entirely different concept. What that means is that the soldiers who are manning these defense systems, the airplanes and the ships and the, you know, the tanks and all of that sort of thing, they're going to desert. Now, what would cause the world's militaries to say, I'm out of here? You know, they're all in a command and control regime where if you leave, you lose your freedom. Mm-hmm. What's the only thing that is worse than losing your freedom? And it's certain loss of freedom if you go AWOL in anybody's military. What's the only thing worse than that?
Total death. I mean,
death, right?
Losing your life.
Death.
Yeah.
Right. So what is happening here?
Well, this we are
seeing that the appalling desolation is taking place. They recognize that when they've witnessed and. I've written a new introduction to the next chapter, which is the Woe to America chapter. Mm-hmm. When this is occurring, we're dealing with an entirely different world. Not all that different than the one we're in right now, but one that is so radically different than anything that could have even been imagined 10 or 20 years ago. And what's different is there are 7 billion smartphones on the planet. Do you know the average time that the world citizens, this would be the citizens of the entire world, do you know the average amount of time they spend per day on the internet? Take a wild guess. This would be the world over, the average amount of time per day.
3 hours.
7 billion people on the planet. Oh, mind you,
I get 4 to 5.
There's a lot of people on the planet, even though there's 7 billion people on the planet, 7 billion smartphones, that don't own one of those. Don't have a computer, not on the internet at all. So the average is going to be influenced by that. What's the average, you think? Which is public?
I don't know, but I assume it's several hours a day, maybe 3, 4. I mean, some of these people own it all day long.
6 3/4.
Wow.
6 3/4.
Wow.
That's all they're doing. In their free time, that is all they're doing. 6 3/4 hours a day.
My God.
So, with 7 billion smartphones, and with broadband, and with video and pictures instantly posted, when Yahweh blows away the 100 million jihadists, mm-hmm, armed with billions of dollars of American weapons, who have, you know, that at first they're going to come in as a flood, as an angry sea. What that means, the way I pictured this in my mind, is that the first 1 million, 2 million, 5 million, 10 million, mm-hmm, are going to be mowed down. There are going to be waves upon waves upon waves of corpses as each successive jihadist climbs to the top of the head, climbing over the dead bodies of those who have been shot, and falls, adding to the height of these waves of human carcasses. But then there just won't be enough bullets. The killing will become overwhelming, and they won't be able to stop the tide. And then when the world is all celebrating the imminent destruction of Israel, they're witnessing the final solution. They're cheering it on. It's inevitable. Israel is indefensible. And now tens of millions, maybe 100 million jihadists screaming their lungs out, barbaric fashion, slashing their way through the population centers of Israel, are blown away. Yeah. They're literally blown away. Now, if you're some dude that's in the infantry with your assault rifle, what are you going to do? You've seen the best of America's weapons wielded by the most devoted militants that outnumber their victims 20-1 in a little tiny indefensible country get blown away. And you've watched it over and over again because the world's going to see it instantly. This is going to be a day where the average internet viewership isn't going to be 6 3/4 hours. Be 3 times that.
Have it on all day long.
So what are you going to do if you've got some general or some admiral, some captain, some lieutenant that's about ready to send you over there to restore order?
No, you
may be able to take my freedom, but whatever happened there, that was some bad shit, man. I ain't going there. They'll walk away. That's a fight man can't win. That becomes obvious. Defensive fortifications are mandated. That, by the way, is really, really important from two perspectives. Mm-hmm. When people today in America talk about having a debt of gratitude, but they say that the group of people that have made it possible for them to be free. Mm. Who do they credit?
The military.
Military.
Correct. Who is our liberator? Right. Who is our liberator?
Yahweh.
What's the first thing he tells us in the first line that he etched on the first tablet in stone? I'm your liberator. I liberated you. My name is Yahweh. I liberated you from the crucible of human oppression, from religious, political, military, and economic slavery. I'm your liberator. And your choice is you can be liberated by God, or you can be enslaved by man. So this human propensity to credit man for their freedom and their military for their independence is shattered.
You know, if I may, I was reading this week about thinking about this very thing, and there's one minor parallel, but one very significant parallel is when the when Yahweh the Ruach Kodesh, the Spirit or the Wind, moved back the waters that destroyed the giant army, the major part of the army of Egypt. And that was reported in other historical accounts. The Amalekites actually saw it, and they were scared absolutely to death when they saw it. Now, that later they tried again, but it's a serious parallel there. But I was also thinking about what the tie-in with Samson, when Samson destroys his whole army with the jawbone on an ass. I mean, that's just funny anyway, because he's wiping out the palace. That wouldn't have scared everybody the way the thing is what happened at the Gulf of Aqaba. So it's exactly what will happen. But the only reason I went there is because of the wind. I was comparing the story there with the wind that later you find up a chair, and a couple of verses later, Yahweh describes the wind both from, it could be from a storm, it could be water, and the wind with the water, you know, or like a whirlwind, which is the way it's described in when they cross the Aqaba. So, but yeah, regardless of that, everybody's going to see it and be scared.
You probably have read it now because I had it originally at the end of this chapter that we're studying right now, chapter 12 of volume 2, beginning to the end. I did a translation of the first 18 stanzas of the Song of the Sea, which is in Shemot, the book of Exodus. Mm-hmm. And it talks about that day, about what happened to the Egyptian.
No, I did not read that, but that's good. Good, good.
Yes, and but it transitions in the middle of it from a story of what happened to the Egyptian military to what's going to happen in the last days. And the Song of the Sea is really an ode to nations like America, which is why I'm moving the Song of the Sea to the next chapter, which is a woe to America. So this then continues and says that not only will his defensive fortifications be abandoned and deserted, it's going to be consistent with an occult presence among the religious and merchants of death. Ka, which means to be similar to, and Shiresh. So similar to the religious writers and the expert enchanters who plot against and devise detrimental plans in concert with Satan, comparable to those who conspire in secret, similar to the environmentalists in wooded areas with mind-altering incantations and biological agents, as it will be with the skilled craftsmen, the artisans, the technical workers, the carpenters, the industrialists, and the aisle makers, whose business is death and destruction from Karash to while preparing potions devised to silence. When the uttermost branch of the olive, therefore, beneficially and to show the way, will be completely deserted for a time. There's going to be a period of time when Yahweh removes his covenant children before there are any more harvestable olives on that tree. And part of it has to be that I said there were two aspects of this abandonment of defensive fortification. The reason I mentioned two is there's a second. The Israeli IDF is going to abandon their posts.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a combination of things, I think. Well, maybe three things. One is that the onslaught is unrelenting and unstoppable.
Yeah.
You know, so there's no other choice but to give up. Number two, they just run out of bullets. I mean, how many bullets can you fire before your gun melts?
Melts.
And you run out of ammunition, right?
Mm-hmm. That's my thought, yeah.
And number three, no matter how hard we work to indoctrinate soldiers to the idea that those they are killing are subhuman and deserve to die, they're justified in killing. Killing is hard.
Always
sickening. So if you're one of the 2 million soldiers that might be on the border, how many people can you kill before you just can't handle anymore?
Nice.
And so I think that's part of it as well. So the IDF deserts their posts. So there'll be an occult presence among the religious and the merchants of death. A lovely juxtaposition of thoughts. And that the most uppermost branch of the olive will be completely deserted for a time because of the presence of the children of Israel. And there's going to be appalling desolation and stupefying ruin. Shema'ah. Stunning and astonishing deflowering and defloration of trees and plant life. Horrible devastation leaving these places ravaged and temporarily uninhabitable. Completely deserted. Desolate. A wasteland clothed in horror. Now when I read those words, personally, what I see is chemical and biological weapons, and it's like Agent Orange and napalm, and of course then just the kinds of nerve gases that are so chlorine kinds of gases. Destroy everything. Kill animal life and kill plant life. And they just leave this hellish image. It's kind of the worst of man. Man, 100 years more retarded than he was in the trench warfare and the chemical warfare of World War I. And of course, the aftermath with the anthrax that Woodrow Wilson perpetrated, killing another over 100 million people.
Yeah.
I think that is what we're witnessing here. I think that's what these words share. I have a very good friend that says, I don't know if there's reason to conclude that. It simply may be that when the Spirit blows these jihadists out of Israel, you know, just the heat of her breath, if you will be enough for total defloration. But I'm not certain that's the case. I'm not certain that's the case. I want to be really careful. Person who wrote me this is got wonderful insights and knows the set apart spirit and God's word intimately. And so when it comes to having a different view, I prefer to celebrate those views. That's why I shared it, as opposed to challenge those views. But one of the reasons that I'm not wholly on board with that view is that Yahweh loves life.
I was just thinking the exact same thing.
he despises religion and militarism and killing anyone who hates and threatens his people and his land.
Mm-hmm.
And so God's really capable. And so if God's going to blow away the religious belligerents, I think that he's, and she in this case, set apart spirit, very capable of blowing them away like tumbleweeds and like chaff in the wind and taking all of their weapons and religious books and materials along with them and blowing them out of the country and destroying them in the process without harming life.
Yeah, it's a precision strike.
I think so.
Yeah, I'm with you. I was thinking the exact same thing. I'm like, that's an interesting way of looking at it, but I don't know. Like you said, Yahweh is just very into life and nature and, you know, all
right.
of that. I don't see him making this desolation. Man is
no.
the one who makes desolation.
That's what I think we're witnessing. I think we're witnessing human desolation. So that's the reason, you know, free will. Yeah. Has allowed man to be man, to do all of those religious and political and military things, and will continue to allow man being man up to the point of he can't allow man to destroy Israel or wipe out his people. He can't allow humanity to completely obliterate the planet or to wipe out life on the planet. But up to that point, he's going to let man be man. And then finally, he's going to stop and say, you know, okay, now, children of Israel, you no longer have a country, any alliances in the world. You no longer have your defense forces. You've got nothing to rely on. Except me.
I mean, back to Egypt, same way.
Right.
Nothing.
Right, nothing. Now, are you going to follow me? Are you going to follow me back home just like you did 3,500 years ago? This time the promised land is the new earth and a restored Israel. So he's doing this for the children of Israel. Because of the appalling desolation and stupefying ruin, a wasteland clothed in horror. Now, what's amazing about this time is that the institutions so many have come to rely on will be failing catastrophically. Religious veneration is going to falter. The military defenses are all going to be abandoned. The merchant of death, the religious writers, the expert enchanters, the detrimental schemers will crash and burn right along with them. Cities will become essentially uninhabitable. There's going to be an occult presence everywhere because that's the driving factor. And the things that are making all of this hellish desolation occur. Now, immediately after the uppermost olives are gleaned, there will be Shamma. Appalling devastation, horrid defloration, stupefying ruin. Likely in proximity to Israel, such that much of the world becomes uninhabitable and life unsustainable. This is clearly the beginning of the worst time of Jacob's troubles. As much as Yahweh wants to reach the children of Israel as a loving father, he cannot allow his family to linger in the midst of such desolation. This indicates that the Teruah harvest is going to spare the covenant's children from having to endure these astonishingly horrible assaults against Israel and a world at war with itself. Yahweh's children are gone. It appears that with the escalation of satanic schemes and rhetoric, the earth is going to be defoliated. I think it suggests the possibility of biological weapons.
You know,
we
could be both. You know, we could be both. And I wrote down Shamim, which is the verb of Shamma.
And everything I found was about like whoever wrote you is about a wasteland being blown away by the wind. However, if they set these things off or they fire these things at those fortifications, these nerve gases, all these different horrible things, was set apart. There, could just simply blow it away. Now you'll blow it back at them, and that will destroy a whole lot of the land. So it's a combination of the two, but he is not going to let it hit Jerusalem. But if you both, I mean, I've always felt that we being human beings do most of the damage. I'm convinced that even that asteroid that hits is going to be. I didn't think about it too much. If I may just interject this, we have been planning. NASA's been planning for years to knock it off its course.
Correct.
And they have unlimited some money to do it. I read not too long ago that Russia has the same plan.
Right.
Russia may not trust them. They might think they're going to knock it into Russia, and they may knock it off where it will fall into.
I'm not convinced. That the world is telling us that those in a position to know are telling us the truth about him in 2004, Apophis.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know that there have been two movies that have been made on asteroids, and in both cases, maybe three, and in each of the cases, the government did everything they could to preclude the people from having that information, because they knew that it would profoundly change people's morals and attitudes. Right. And so, what's been announced is that MN 2004 on I think it's Friday, April 13th, 2029, is supposed to come with inside of the satellite ring, the satellite orbits of Earth.
Yes.
I mean, like, you know, only 5% between here and the moon.
Mm-hmm.
So within the satellite orbit. And it's not a planet killer, because God couldn't allow that. It is devastating. You know, if it hits the Atlantic or the Pacific, there'll be a 500-foot tsunami moving at 500 miles an hour. That everything, you know, 500 feet and below, and depending on the Atlantic or the Pacific, is along the shoreline, is wiped out. You know, if it hits the Northeast Corridor, it would be like thousands of nuclear bombs.
Mm-hmm.
It is a devastating asteroid. And it's so close that anything that affects it in the orbit between now and then, a slight acceleration, a slight deceleration, something that has a gravitational pull that in all of the travel in that long orbit just nudges it ever so slightly. But it could be, as you guys are forecasting, that it is going to hit, or that it's so close to hitting that as it does a flyby between now and then further away, that NASA and Russia and others, China, are going to attempt to nudge it. Just to see, can we do this kind of thing? And their nudging is going to be catastrophic if that occurs. So, the Carnegie Viejo, which is the likely for the volcanic mountain that's going to fall into the sea, I don't think it's, I think it's an act of nature.
Mm-hmm.
It's imminent. It's timing. It could well be the asteroid hits. That's more than enough to jettison that landslide. So, it all could be just things that happen quite naturally. Their timing, though, is so suspect. You know, it certainly appears like it was part of the equation put into the system. But, you know, God's got to bring this to a head. So the degree that man starts killing man, you know, after a while, it's just like with the IDF forces. If there's 100 million Muslims trying to flood into Israel, after a while they're going to become so shell-shocked that they just won't be able to fire anymore. And man, having seen what God's doing, is going to have a tough time keeping up the battle. but yet it's all got to come to a close by his return on Yom Kippurim in year 6000, 2033. And so, you know, God may well have said, well, you know, these are some things that will bring it all to a head. This next statement, it's Yashiyahu 17:10, it reads, indeed because. So this is all happening because. So this calamity and having endured is all happening because you have completely ignored and have actually forgotten, becoming totally ignorant of, ceasing to care about, overlooking, no longer remembering, improperly responding to, forgetting about the God of your salvation and deliverance. And the rock of your protection and refuge you do not remember or mention. Therefore you plant Adonis, the Lord's vines, and erect his dwellings. And you continually sow it as an illegitimate, unauthorized, and loathsome means to estrangement via vine and branch that needs to be pruned. The first thing on the list is the most devastating. Indeed, because you have completely ignored and have actually forgotten, becoming totally ignorant of the God of your salvation. Most populous religion on the planet, what is that, guys? Overwhelmingly the most popular.
Christianity.
Yeah. Christianity. Who is the savior in Christianity?
Jesus.
Jesus.
Is Yahweh ever credited with salvation?
Never. His name is not even allowed.
No.
Or spoken.
So, of the 2.5 billion or more Christians on the planet, they are completely ignorant of the God of their salvation. I mean, even the right name of Jesus, Yahusha, means Yahweh saves, for crying out loud.
Mm-hmm.
Yahweh is the Savior. Of course, is there a Savior in the Rabbinic Judaism? There isn't one.
No,
there isn't one.
Right,
you know, Rabbinic Judaism doesn't have, you know, the standard heavens and hells, and doesn't have a Savior. You know, there's really not even a God. It's Hashem. But this word that comes next is Adonis. Is therefore you plant Adonis' residences and gardens. Have you ever heard of a Hebrew word that's
Adonai,
the basis for Adonis?
Just a little.
Adonai.
Yeah. Adonai.
My Lord.
My Lord. What did the rabbis do? They replaced Yahweh's name 7,000 times with Adonai. My Lord. And this prophecy is precise. And of course, is there a God of salvation in Islam? No. The terrorist God of death.
Nothing even close to that.
Right. And his name is Allah. Indeed, because you have completely ignored and you have actually forgotten. In Christianity, it's just completely ignored. Being ignorant of. And in Rabbinic Judaism, they've totally forgotten the God of their salvation. And the rock of your protection and refuge, that's the, you know, Yahweh uses this term, sure rock, quite often. And the idea is, a rock is reliable, it's dependable, it's when you chisel something in stone, it's endures. There is no magic eraser for something chiseled in stone. It'll blot it out. It endures. A house built on a foundation of stone can endure. A house built of stone will endure. And so that rock upon which we are protected is Yahweh. But we don't remember or mention him. You know, but the Catholics were laying carpet for me in a home that I owned in Ohio when I had this conversation about that there was never anyone named Jesus. There was never a title Christ. And I said, but, you know, how dare you say that when God said, Jesus said, upon this rock I will build my church. And, of course, that is the Roman Catholic Church. And he said, nothing of the sense. Nothing of the sort. He didn't even get close to that. And we'll just talk about that in a minute. It's not what he said. Therefore, you plant Adonis's, the Lord's, gardens and his dwellings. It's interesting that Net ties both the word for vines and dwellings. Your husbandsman to arrange and nurture his gardens and establish his residences. Representing the unfaithful home of religious misunderstanding. And you sow it as an illegitimate, unauthorized, and loathsome means to estrangement. That is rabbinic Judaism. That is Christianity. That is Islam. It's a loathsome means to estrangement that has been sown by man. And if you really want to look at it, this garden of that was been sown in the name of the Lord, Adonai, particularly by Jews, is Christianity, is Islam. Christianity was founded by a Jew named Shaul, a rabbi.
Well, the rabbis certainly helped Islam, too.
Well, without the rabbis, and by the way, Muhammad, there's a 75% likelihood that Muhammad was a Jew. Three quarters of the population of Yathrib, named Yathrib for a reason where he was born, were Jewish. And the ones that could afford to send a precocious, difficult child off to be raised by Bedouins were the Jews. They're the only ones that made any money, had the means to do so. So it's better than the 75% likelihood that he was Jewish. And beyond that, if he hadn't bought Talmud citations from the rabbis, which then he put into his Quran, bastardizing them and twisting them, the Quran wouldn't have fooled a fool. Would have been a bunch of surahs that are regurgitated paganism from the Hanifs, who are, by the way, also Jewish, that would have been so clumsy, so thin, that the stuff that followed it, which was Muhammad's armed robbery of his former clan, would have been laughable. And so was the credibility of those rabbinic stories recited from the Talmud that Muhammad twisted that made Islam possible. So the world's two most popular religions.
The third, you consider
the fact that the authors of socialist secular humanism were also Jewish.
Yes. Hitler.
Hitler was... I mean, Hitler did the same thing Muhammad did.
His grandparents. Yeah.
Right. Destroy the records. Any record of his birth, he destroyed. Yeah. Hitler was very likely Jewish. Now, this is not to demean Jews. They don't need me criticizing them. They do plenty on their own to earn people's wrath. And the fact is that even though God constantly says, you know, you aren't lovable, they're still yes, chosen people. And, you know, I've devoted my time to sharing what Yahweh has to say about them and says for them. And there's no people on earth that I care more about, because quite frankly, the God I've come to know and love cares more about them than anyone else.
Question.
But he does not mince words. He tells them exactly what they have done that is wrong. And so there is nothing wrong with us affirming that they've actually in a very, very bad way.
That's what a loving father does. That's what a loving friend does.
Exactly.
You know, I've had to have that conversation with my daughter several times lately as she's growing and, you know, she's getting into that kind of hitting phase. And, you know, we're having that conversation. No, that is not what we do. And, you know, I get on to her for it. She gets punished. We've had to take away toys, timeouts, and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, that's what you do. You don't let them continue to do the bad thing. You know, as a loving parent, you intervene, you correct them, and you explain to them why it was wrong.
Exactly. By the way, just as an added insight on Muhammad, because it's would be just it's almost impossible for a Muslim to believe that Muhammad was actually Jewish. But he was born into the Bana Hashem clan of the Quraysh tribe. Banu Hashem, the sons of the name.
Man's Jewish.
So, yeah, there you go. In a place called Yathrib. Yah loves Israel. Not for what it has become, but for what it can be. And he's going to honor his promises to Israel. And so, it's important that they know, as you have just iterated, JB, that as a loving father, we need our children to know the truth. We need them to know when they're acting badly. As Yahweh said, you sow illegitimate, unauthorized, and loathsome means to estrangement. He's telling them just the way it is. They're nauseating. They've alienated themselves from him. And therefore, they become a branch that needs to be pruned. Now, he didn't say they become a branch that needs to be uprooted. He didn't say a branch that needs to be poisoned. He didn't say a branch that needs to be torched, but one that needs to be pruned. Mm-hmm. Now, Yahweh loves agricultural symbolism. You know, for most of his history, man has lived and worked in agrarian communities. And that's where these metaphors would have resonated. They still do today. If you recall, it wasn't all that long ago that Yah spoke of planting and tending his garden with his beloved son, Dod. So now we are confronted with a garden of a different sort. One devoted to rooting the Lord in the land and spreading Satan's seeds. And we talked about this briefly, but the rock metaphor is indicative of several important aspects of Yah's nature and his plan. First, he is steadfast, as in the case with many large rock. Second, his light and Torah were presented atop a rocky summit, Horeb. Third, Yah's instructions are chiseled in stone, making them dependable and unchanging. Sur therefore alludes to the non-eroding, rock-solid, unchanging nature of Yahweh's testimony and to the enduring validity of his promises. And fourth, rocks were used to build large and enduring homes. And none is larger or more enduring than his. I also mentioned the sewer plays an essential role in one of Yahweh's most misquoted and misunderstood statements. The disciple Shimon answered the question, who do you say that I am? With, you are the Maaseh Yah, the work of Yahweh, the Son of God. This question, the disciples answer, and also Yosha's subsequent reply, were all spoken in their native tongue. In Hebrew, in the language of God. Recognizing this, Yosha exclaimed, Alzeath, Sur, Ibana, E, Mikre, which means, upon this rock, I will build my invitations to be called out and to meet. Yosha did not rename Shimon Peter. He did not say anything about establishing his church, but he did say that he was responsible for establishing his mikre on the summit of the rock we know as Moriah.
there's a lot we can learn from the Garden of Adonis. It is from Na Amonim. It was used here as an epithet for the gardens and residences of Adonis the Lord. It was used throughout the Canaanite mythological texts. Its literature is found in the Ugarit and Egyptian hieroglyphics. The root is used to describe the attractive nature of the leading deities, which were Anath and Baal. Baal was, of course, the Lord. Anath was both Baal's sister and helpmate, illegitimate, of course, incestuous, of course, as well as his lover and consort. She was best known for fighting Baal's battles. She is said to be the blessed virgin. The Egyptians saw Astarte and Anath as equivalent. And during the Hellenistic age, Anath and Astarte were blended together. In Hebrew, the root meaning beloved singer, beloved and singer, presents the Lord as a counterfeit for Dode, the beloved songwriter of Yah. Now, as we know, all paths do not lead to God. In fact, all but one leads away from him. The seeds sown by religion produce illegitimate and estranged children. Such growth is loathsome, nauseating from God's perspective, and as a result will be pruned away and discarded. So it is telling that Zar, unauthorized, foreign, and wrong, is based on Zur. That speaks of being estranged and subsequently crushed by a whore and harlot. So once again, we're reminded of the whore of Babylon and the leading role man's religious schemes play in his downfall. It's also telling that Zamora reveals the reason that the alien vine has to be pruned. It is not only a secondary branch, similar to the Talmud and the New Testament. It, like them, is associated with pagan rituals and worship. There's a lot to this, and particularly Na Amonim Nata, Adonis the Lord, the residences of Adonis. The worst part of it all is Adonis is written Adonai in Hebrew, the satanic title. The Israelites have deployed 7,000 times in place of Yahweh's name, thereby serving as the literal fulfillment of this prophecy. Adonis, under a variety of names, is a central figure in most religious mythologies. Adonis's death, like the dying of the Christian god, kept the Lord forever young, youthful and beautiful, and thus more appealing than the father of the gods. He's the President John Kennedy, who never grows old. Not only is the Christian Jesus designed to serve a more appealing replacement for the God of the Old Testament, keep in mind that Satan, represented by the Lord, is physically beautiful and appears desirable. Adonis became the model of the Christian Christ with his annual death and rebirth, but also telling, this mythical God is said to have become immortal. In this light, Adonis is the derivative of the Babylonian Talmuz, the Assyrian Baal, the Egyptian Osiris, and even the Greek Dionysus, the Roman Bacchus. Adonis, like Tammuz, was killed by a wild boar, like Nimrod, the forerunner of Tammuz. He was considered a mighty hunter. His violent death became the foundation for the Israelite propensity to weep for Tammuz. It's the myth which underlies the Roman Catholic devotion to Lent. Hauntingly, when the Lord Adonis died, his blood was said to bring forth new life, just as it does in the Christian religion, a belief system concocted and promoted by a Benjamite Jew, Shaul, who became the Roman Paul. You know, there's the prophecy of the Benjamite being the wolf, and of course, Yosha talking about how the wolf is going to snatch them away.
Yeah.
What was Paul's most famous letter? What letter is the Magnus Opus, the foundation of the Christian religion?
Romans.
Mm-hmm. And Shaul changed his name to what kind of a name?
Roman.
Yeah, Latin Roman name, right?
Yeah.
The mythology of Rome. Rome was suckled by what?
The two wolves.
And so the Roman Catholic Church was suckled by what?
Wolf. Of course.
A Vigilite wolf.
Yeah.
It's just delectable, isn't it?
It really is. It really is. If you're not reading this, you're having fun.
Yeah. According to the Greeks, Adonis was born in guess what place? Byblos.
Close enough.
His name was co-opted to become Bible. Similarly, the legend of the Christian Jesus, as authored by Paul, was born in the same place, the New Testament of the Christian Bible. His, the son of Phoenix, Adonis, like Jesus, was conceived to die and be resurrected. And Walter Burkett's Greek Religion, we find insights which also shed some additional light on Yahweh's prophecy regarding Adonis and the religious worship of the Lord, especially in the context with planting and sowing. He would write, "Women would sit by the gate, weeping for Tammuz, or they would offer incense to Baal on rooftops and plant pleasant plants." These were the very features of the Adonis legend, which was celebrated on the flat rooftops on which seeds were sown, which quickly germinated, creating Adonis Gardens, where the climax was a loud lamentation for the dead god. As was the case with Asherah, the Adonis cult provided an opportunity for the unbridled expression of emotion, especially in the women. And then the great celebration when the god awoke from his death. You know, according to William Smith in a dictionary of Greek and Roman antiquities, he says that this festival of Adonis was celebrated over 2 days. On the first day, the statues of Adonis were laid out as corpses, dead god on a stick. And the faithful observed all of the rites customary at funerals, beating themselves and uttering lamentations, imitating the cries of Venus, their Roman name for Asherah, over the death of her lover. The second day was spent in merriment and feasting because Adonis was allowed to return to life, resurrected. The Lord. Remarkably similar to the Christian festivals of Good Friday and Easter Sunday, isn't it? Moreover, considering the fact that this prophecy began in Damascus, Syria, the Adonis cult migrated from Athens to Syria in the 2nd century CE, coterminous with the time of the birth of the Christian religion. Oops. Well, we can begin, fellas, 1711. Of Yeshayah, and recognizing that in a matter of moments we'll no longer be broadcasting, but we'll continue to record for a while longer, and then maybe open with it a week from now, because it still focuses on a garden. And it says, "In that day, your garden, you will sow, and you will cause to grow, then carefully construct a barrier around it. And in the early part of the day, when such things are considered, your seed will bud and sprout, sending out shoots, which will be heaped up and held on the wrong side of the barrier, having wavered and wandered away. In the daytime, there will be terminal disease and hopeless infirmity, weakness and affliction, great tribulation, including the influence of incurable and mortal grief and mental anguish." So God basically said, it's the referendum. You got a choice. We can till Yah's garden for all it's worth, benefit from what he has offered and remove the weeds that men have spread. That's why I like beginning this program with J.K.'s letter. That's what he's done.
Mm-hmm.
So we've all striven to do. We can ignore what God's conveyed, as is becoming ever more popular today. Or we can do as the religious have done and set out plants we prefer over God's. And that is the point being made here. It's not Yah's garden, but instead Netta'ata, your garden. And you'll notice that those who prefer theirs over his deliberately build a hedge around their notions, ostensibly to keep faith confined and their critics at bay.
Kind of like Cain, isn't it? His sacrifice, or his offering for the party.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, they can't handle the criticism.
You know, no,
there is an aspect of all of this, though, that is that's something I don't even know how we came to this conclusion, but we did many, many years ago. And the conclusion was that for all of human history, since year one, Yah, through probably 3 years or so from 6,000 Yah, that through all of that time, man has had three options in terms of the ultimate destination of his soul or her soul.
Mm-hmm.
One of those options is we can choose to come to know Yahweh, appreciate who he is, and understand what he's offering, and respond appropriately to the terms of the covenant. We can answer his invitation and attend his invitations to meet with him. And we can end up spending our eternity adopted into his family, immortal, perfected, empowered, and enriched. That's a really good choice. Best choice there is.
That's my option.
That's my option, too. I'm coming with that option.
I don't even need to hear the others.
Yeah, that's true. But for all of human history, there have been two other options. One is really, really bad. And it is the option, as Yahweh constantly points out, because the primary theme of Yahshayah thus far has been to criticize religion. And that is the religious option where you're actually promoting religion. You're a leader religiously. You're a scholar. You're a theologian. Or even a leading politician or general. In that case, you have chosen by your profession, by your attitude, by what you have done, to get people to follow you, which is to lead them away from God. And for that, there is a consequence. And that's the eternal separation. What we learned a week ago is, or 2 weeks ago, is essentially a black hole. Not essentially, but it is a black hole.
Yeah.
Sheol is a black hole, a lightless place where souls are imprisoned forever. But 99.9%, the vast preponderance of human souls, just simply cease to exist. There's no punishment. There's no reward. They were given a mortal existence. They were given a conscience, consciousness, and a wonderful place to express them. And for those who just didn't care enough and they were ignorant of God, they believed others foolishly, don't know who God is, haven't acted upon his instructions, they souls just simply cease to exist. But when we reach this final crescendo of bad human behavior, in this referendum between Satan's desire to worship his God and to battle against Yahweh and his chosen people, as we near the time of Yah's return, he's got to bring it all to a head. Because the moment he returns is going to be family and not family.
Mm-hmm.
Friend and foe. And there's no middle ground anymore.
No, then it is.
And so those who have chosen poorly, those who are either ignorant of Yahweh or opposed to Yisrael, that the infirmity that they have now brought upon themselves is incurable. There is a period of time where I think apart from the remnant of Israel, that if you're not on the right side, you will no longer have the time to choose. So if you're listening to this and you're in the midst of the time of Jacob's trouble, you do not have the luxury of time. You either choose Yahweh or you're going to be deemed incurable, unsavable. And that's the bottom line here. So, however we came to embrace this conclusion has now been verified. There is a time coming where the plague of death is no longer resolvable. And I'm glad that time hasn't already occurred, because I would be unredeemable.
Yeah.
I was a Pauline Christian. I promoted this muck. I led Bible studies on Paul's letters. I was wrong. And fortunately, I was wrong at a time when there was still hope. Still an opportunity. Still a cure. But that's not going to continue. So sometime, and I can't, I don't want to put a date on it, but you know, if it's just to give people a general idea, as early as 2029, but probably no later than 2032, somewhere in that period, maybe all of that period, religion is going to be a fatal offense. Being in the military will be a fatal offense. Being in politics, supporting the politicians, celebrating your faith is all fatal. You know, it's been interesting in these last couple of weeks, I've had almost every other day met someone that engaged in long conversation about the Torah, the prophets, the Psalms, the truth about Paul, Muhammad, who God really is, what he's offering, the fact that religions don't lead to him, but instead away from him, the horrible condition of English translations, the fact God is anti-religious. I've had it with so many people, and I haven't had a single conversation with a person I was talking to said, no, you can't, I don't want to hear that, I'm religious. They were all open. They were all receptive. Everything I said resonated. They couldn't wait to read. Now, I don't know how many of these will come to know the truth. You know, this week, two people.
That's it.
That's wrote me and said they did.
Five years ago, where most people were against it. They were just appalled that you would even mention it.
Right. And times are changing.
Yeah.
You know, people are a lot more receptive. People will come and work on the boat and somehow get in a conversation and say, you know, I really want to read those books. I want to know what you learn. I am open-minded. I do want to know. I'm willing to invest the time. Help me learn. Now, you know, maybe of those that are receptive, that 1 out of 10 of them will actually come to know the truth. But that is so different than what I experienced 10, 15, 20 years ago. Oh. And so I had my... you know, I think everybody here knows how close I am to Jackie. I'm close to Jackie. I've never met personally, never seen a picture of Jackie, never talked to Jackie on the phone. Our relationship is strictly email. But it's amazing how great an affinity you can have for someone exchanging emails. And she is really devoted to improving the quality of these chapters and books that we're sharing. Yeah, it was testimony, and she said this marvelous influence on her family. So she is, and almost everybody that knows her just loves Jackie. And you know, she wrote me just the other day talking about these very same things, and how, from her perspective, that my looking at the of the 7,000, the 3,000 Israelites, 4,000 Gentiles that are going to be harvested, and which is falls into that, so 7 million people, that's 1 in a million. The same number as the second statement of Stone. She says, when you look at the community of those who are reading and listening to this show, reading these books on Yada Yada, Introduction to God and Questioning Paul, and are part of the various communities that that communicate among one another, that doesn't seem possible that even given another 7-8 years, that the number's going to be 7,000. Yeah, and you may want to write it to 700 to 7,000. And I did. I changed it. And part of the reason I changed it is that this is one of those people, and there's a lot that I correspond with that they know Yahweh. They know his testimony. They understand what's happening. And so I respect their position. And any time that they add something, I'm going to do everything I can to include it. Now, this is one where I don't agree. Actually, the more I think about it, I don't agree. But I still want the possibility of that in this chapter, and I've included it in the chapter because this is an insight gleaned by someone that I knows Yahweh intimately and spends more time communicating with the members of the covenant than most anyone else. But I do think that the Yahweh's math is going to hold true. That when he says thousands amongst billions, it's 1 in a million, and that the math is going to be a million times the, or a thousand times the seven, as opposed to 100 times the 7. And I'm going to say that. So here, I am not negating in any way the 700. I'm just sharing why I'm going to advocate for 1,000 or 7,000. And the first is, one of the things I've learned in associating with Yahweh is it's a really good idea to be an optimist. God's not a pessimist. He's an optimist. And so, when it comes to his family, I'm going to be an optimist. I see the possibilities. The message is resonating with more and more people. I see the trend. More and more letters from people that have had their lives transformed. And the majority of the people who are writing, who are coming to know Yahweh and participating in his invitations to meet, and who are accepting the terms and conditions of the covenant, they aren't in forums. And I've been really reluctant since that whole disaster of what was the name of that? I don't want to say it. I don't want to say the name of the website, but nor the individual that made it his personal fiefdom. By the way, that individual now is claiming that the translations are his own. So he's still using it. He doesn't have claim. Someone went there the other day, incognito, and he's now claiming they're his own. That's pathetic. And then we had the other one that turned from a really wonderful guy, it seemed like, to anti-Semitic. And so I'm really concerned about social media and forums and all of that sort of thing. So you notice I never mention any of them anymore. And I know there are some good ones. I know that there's lots of people that correspond with one another, and I want to encourage that to the maximum degree. But there isn't a singular forum where everybody is corresponding. Like I mentioned, J.K., who wrote this marvelous letter to a number of people today, because I was so touched by his letter. I mean, the letter just to me, it was just, I just love that kind of writing with the humor in it and all of the insights and the way that it's woven together and so friendly and approachable and instructive. And I shared this was written by somebody that I've been corresponding with for a lot of years. And not a single person knew him. And yet, he is absolutely part of Yahweh's family, a beloved member of Yahweh's family, something I care deeply about. And so there, I share all that to say that I think there's more of us than we know. And that
I think
the number is about
down
to
that point where that, when we, as it narrows down to that point where that choice is going to be taken away, I think, yeah, part of that is going to be Yahweh kind of revoking that choice, but a lot of that's going to be the world and man pushing it to the point where you're not, they're not going to, you know, man's not going to let you be in that middle point anymore. You are going
Correct.
To be part of this. Or you
the hallmark
not.
Of the beast concept.
Oh, yeah.
And I think when we get to that point, it's going to be easier for people to, or not necessarily easier, but people are going to be more likely to, you know, if they have to pick a side, to evaluate it more realistically. And, talking about, you know, more and more people that you talk to are more receptive than they used to be. I think that's going to be a trend that will continue.
Yeah. And I think something else is going to happen.
We might see exponential growth within that period. You know, if it were to happen now, 700 probably would be, I think a high estimate. But, you know, in the next 7 years, if it grows exponentially, 7,000 could be doable.
Yes. Particularly recognizing that over the next 7 or 8 years, there's a lot of bad stuff going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes when it takes a lot of bad stuff, that's the whole story being told there. Really bad stuff, appalling devastation and desolation is going to be all around and within Israel. And that's what it takes for the children of Israel to finally look at Yahweh and recognize that he's their Savior, their rock.
That's the story of Hezekiah.
That is the story
when all else failed.
Hezekiah didn't come.
To Yahweh.
Right. Right. Yeah. If somebody had brought Hezekiah the Torah when his alliances and tributes to the Assyrians or the Egyptians was prevailing, he probably would have just said, okay, well, that's nice. Yeah. Don't bother me. I've got a harem to enjoy here. But the fact that his tributes had failed and he got 185,000 of the best soldiers on the planet surrounding your city, and they've already wiped out all of the northern kingdom and much of Yehuda, and you're last. And somebody brings you this marvelous and wonderful book called the Torah that just resonates with every fiber of your soul and mind, heart, when you read it. And it has the answer to this problem. All of a sudden you're saying, whoa, God hates religion, and look what we've done. We've got religious artifacts everywhere. Let's get rid of all this religious stuff. Let's celebrate Pesach and Matzah and Bukkotim. And let's see what happens. We don't have to wait to see what happens. We know what's going to happen. The promise is there. But do you think he would have done it had there, you know, been three Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts selling cookies outside the door of Jerusalem?
No, we wait for pressure before we do anything.
Yeah, we do. It's the human way. Now, I'm going to tell you, it's a really bad choice because you aren't giving up anything. Be part of God's family, you're gaining everything. anything. We gained everything. And this notion that, oh, don't take my faith away from me. It's all I've got.
No, you got a Torah.
If you replace faith in that which is untrue, counterproductive, with something that is knowable, useful, absolutely true, uplifting, empowering, you've lost nothing. You've gained everything.
Gained everything.
Right. So I get asked all the time, so what do you believe?
Nothing.
I don't believe. I know. You know, in this world, either know or I don't know. And what I know is that Yah was God's name, that he proved that he authored the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. And in them, there are the terms and conditions for participating in the covenant and for meeting with him, being part of his family. And what I know is not only does he prove his existence and his authorship, his inspiration of those books, he's not only anti-religious, he's a really nice guy.
I tell people, you know, belief belongs in the realm of opinion. Yeah, I believe vanilla ice cream is better than chocolate ice cream. That's a belief. It's my belief. It's an opinion. Yeah, that's where belief belongs. In the realm of
fact, and you're wrong, because chocolate chip ice cream that combines both of them is the best ice cream.
Chocolate-covered almonds.
No, I'm not going to mess up my ice cream with something that's actually good for you, so I'm sorry. You're wrong, too.
Okay, just chunks of chocolate.
You know, that is the perfect example. Here's the three of us have entirely different opinions and proclivities about ice cream. Now, what's the difference in that in religion?
Nothing.
There's
no evidence to support either one.
So, right.
Opinions. Yeah, it's all a matter of what you pick and choose.
Personal taste.
Yeah.
People say, well, that's not what Christmas or Easter or Halloween means to them. Well, you know, it's not what pistachio ice cream means to me either. You know? Yeah. It's amazing, as knowable as God is. People choose to believe.
Yeah, I do. Well,
truly amazing. Well, we've rambled on here for another almost 30 minutes after the end of the broadcast, but I did want to get through 1711. We may repeat the end of it, because it's important for people to know that you don't have all day. You don't have an unlimited amount of time to make this choice. And, you know, it's not like you're going to be deprived of anything. If you choose, you know, you lose nothing, you gain everything. Yahweh said that Dod was right, and he said, I am his father, he is my son. When you come across Dod, do you think that guy was deprived of anything?
No.
Yeah.
Not a thing.
Oh, he was oversupplied.
He was oversupplied.
He didn't feel like he was being denied. I've read this.
No. Yeah, I've had people say, you know, that Dod sounds really whiny, that, you know, he's complaining about everything. No.
No.
Dod only complains about one thing. Those who are adversary to him, to Yahweh, and to Yisrael. He knew what to hate. He knew why to hate. But everything else he has to say is wonderfully uplifting and positive. In Dod's world, it's probably 80%, 90% uplifting and positive, 10%. Yeah, those who would do harm to Yisrael, diminish Yahweh, or harm him, represent Yisrael, maybe 10 to 15%. But you're reading Yeshayah, Mm-hmm. Yeshayah's criticism of religious man, political man, militant man, is, what, 70% of the text?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's overwhelming. So, you know, Dode is, to a large degree, is mirroring Yahweh. So I told this guy we're having this conversation with, you know, David's really complaining. He said, not nearly as much as Yahweh does.
No.
You know, it's really essential that we understand what to dislike and how important it is to dislike.
Before you get back to Aaron, let me ask you a question. Have you got a final one now on this? I have like 132 pages one I'm working on, and that's fine. I've got, going through it. But this, to me, is probably such a great read. This chapter is just a fabulous chapter. And is it something in the form now that JB would be able to?
Well, thank you for saying that. I would say yes with just one small caveat. Mm-hmm. I did reduce it. I don't know if it was this morning or yesterday.
You said about 100 pages or something.
No, that's down to 100 pages. I took 40 pages out of it. Now, the 40 pages I took out of it, 37 of those pages I transferred into the next chapter. So the discussion on the Mizmor and the Song of the Sea, I moved into the next chapter. And so all of it will appear again. But it makes this chapter a little easier to process. And so that has been edited like 7 or 8 times. And it's ready to go with one exception. And then normally when I finish a chapter, I'll do a read-through beginning to end. And on this particular chapter, I've done a read-through through the first like 20 pages. And so I have 80 pages to go on the read-through. For the last 5 or 6 days, I'll read through maybe 4 or 5 pages because, quite honestly, the read-through is less fun for me than translating the new chapter.
Right.
So, I'm off spending, I'm now like 10 pages into the next chapter, which is actually 18, And thus far, what I've learned on 18 is I was just a nincompoop when I wrote this thing the first time. Now, by saying that, I want to be fair to myself here. It's just like the 17th chapter, the 18th chapter. I didn't find anything in the 17th chapter that I screwed up on in the sense of commission, where I said something that later on further inspection, either in the translation or the commentary, it turned out to be untrue. So that's pretty good.
Yeah.
For me anyway. But what I found is the stuff that I left out that you can glean by having, spent the last 5, 6, 7 years learning, the stuff I left out is, oh my goodness, and how profound it was, and powerful it was, and interesting it was, and helpful that it was. And then, as I'm doing the 18th chapter, I'm just a few words into the second statement, but just in that first statement. Well, when you see it, you're going to be amazed as to how much was there all along. So I guess that's the thrill of it for me is you just go through each word and now it's our microscope for examining these is better equipped.
Can I share one little silly thing with you?
Sure.
When we were doing, a minute ago on the 1710, it was like a Natal to plant or establish a garden. Trees and vines, and I kept digging, and it also means a plantation. And I thought, how appropriate. A plantation is a beautiful agricultural place. It's all the work is done by slaves. They're just little for me. And
I know.
I don't. We don't have time for me to throw all these things. I don't want to interrupt the flow of everything. But
there's
so many of these things that are worth digging just for fun. I mean, it's just like, you couldn't be more clear. Yahweh couldn't be any more clear if he tried. I mean, he says this is...
Oh, I know. There's so many insights there. And one of the challenges, in fact, it gets even better, I mean, amazingly better in the 18th chapter, this next chapter of Observations for a Time, which is 13, Volume 2, Chapter 13, is that there is so much that it's hard to stay off track.
You learn so much from each rabbit hole you go down that you don't
right.
stop.
Right. And I never would have thought something like the Song of the Sea would be applicable to an end times prophecy.
No, I can see that.
And yet it ends with Edom, which is Esau. Esau is the Roman Catholic Church. Rome morphed into the Roman Catholic Church as Esau. And Moab, which is principally Pauline Christianity.
Oh, absolutely. Okay.
Being destroyed. Yeah, Moab, I ended up having to, as I was writing the chapter that's previous to 17, which we have not gone over on one of these shows, every description that Yahweh had of who these people are, because Moab doesn't exist anymore, hadn't existed in a long time, means question your father. So he's talking about a people that are very prevalent and very antagonistic towards Israel in the last days.
Mm-hmm.
And so it can't be Moab. Moab had existed for well over 2,000 years. So who do they represent? And all of the description of these people is Pauline. Everything he has to say about them is Pauline. And so, can you bring in a little bit of a mix of socialist secular humanism? Yeah, a little bit. Here and there. But it's... When you look at who Moab was, the son of an incestuous relationship, the son of a father and daughters who emerged from Sodom, it becomes obvious with Pauline Christianity. And the reason I mentioned the Song of the Sea is that Roman Catholicism and Pauline Christianity are wiped out right at the same time.
Here, here.
And they're wiped out right along with Islam. It's all gone. The two biggest religions in the world. So it is just profound. And, this nation that's being condemned in Yeshaya 18. The second statement is they're sending battle groups, warships, across the sea. And then that's why the Song of the Sea is prophetic of how all that's going to end. So it is, that's the biggest challenge of all, is how much of this can you cover without just overwhelming the reader? And I had two of my favorite readers both say, I think you need to cut this one down.
You just have to go real slow when you read it. I mean, that's what I'm saying.
You need to cut this one down.
I take them one verse at a time and one word at a time, and then sit back and say, look at there.
But I think it's also just as you said, and I've had so many comments on this, that the rewrite of this, which is now, it's even in the rewrite moving everything out, it was 3 times the length, but it's now left at 2 times the length of the versions 7 or 8 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's a grabber.
You're moving some forward, so that's fine.
Oh man, it's. It's really powerful, and it's really powerful set after the chapter on Moab.
Well, I'm telling you, if the number's going to go exponential, as JB is saying, and then
this chapter will have a lot to do with it. I truly believe
so.
This is you can't ignore this stuff, and you can't retranslate it different. I mean, I've looked at everything. I'm the lightweight among you two, without question. But even as I look at it, even through my favorite little forms with the letters and everything, I mean, this is even is. I wouldn't come up with a different concept. And I'm not trying to pat y'all on the back or anything. I'm just
there's no lightweight shower. That's really why I wanted to begin this with JK's letter. It's a community of people who have been enriched and empowered, and we're all contributing, and that's the joy of the whole thing, is that everybody's making a contribution.
Sure.
Everyone's thoughtful. Mm-hmm. You know, one of my favorite people is Dode from Down Under, David down in New Zealand. Mm-hmm. And some of the insights that he's provided in these last chapters are marvelous, thoughtful, engaging. And so we really are all learning from one another. It's a marvelous experience. All right, it's time to say good night. We'll happy Shabbat. Look forward to meeting with everybody again this time next week.
Bye-bye, JB.
I'm good.
Shabbat shalom.
Enjoy your weekend.
Shabbat shalom.
Thank you. Good night.
Night.